Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. A 23-year-old white Christian man planted homemade bombs throughout the city of Austin over a three-week span, killing two people and terrorizing an entire community. But was it terrorism? Today we're talking about why or whether it matters how a crime and the perpetrator are identified and defined. Joining us is legal director for the Columbus chapter of the Council on American-Islamic Relations, Roman Iqbal. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
And also, Emily Davidson built and teaches a course on media and terrorism at Ohio State University. She joins us. Welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So for your purposes, Emily, how is terrorism defined? What are we talking about?
Well, I think that's part of the problem is that terrorism is defined in lots of different ways by lots of different organizations. And the key things that we see in these multiple definitions are things like premeditation, political goals, and using terrorism as essentially a form of rhetoric, of a way to express an idea or gain attention for an idea. And I think that's why a lot of organizations are hesitant to use the word terrorism until they can find out the motivations. And even when they do find out the motivations, it's not necessarily labeled as terrorism if those motivations don't line up with what we typically address as terrorism.
So often people are killed in the process of stopping the perpetrators. They're killed. We don't really know. We know what they leave behind. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that's evidence that they've been looking at websites that endorse or promote terrorist acts, and sometimes it's not. How much can we really draw from any kind of evidence left behind by someone who's been killed? How do you really know?
I think you can look to whether or not there's a broader ideology that they're seeking out online. So if they're just looking for bomb-making equipment, for example, you can have someone who doesn't necessarily have a broader ideology who just wants to inflict harm. That's just something that maybe they get pleasure out of, which is some of the people who have listened to the audio of the or seen the video of the Austin bomber think that that may be where his motivations lay, and that he was just trying to hurt people and enjoyed hurting people. Whereas if you're looking at a broader community, so for example, white nationalism, where you have this ideology where you're linking it to an idea that you as a person are under threat and terrorism is a way to act out against it, that kind of online activity can direct a person to use terrorism as a voice for that community.
There is a difference, though, legally, right?
Right.
What is that?
Well, I'm not the legal expert here, but
Roman Iqbal, then.
Yes. So the legal definition of terrorism is very different from what is used in the media and common parlance among the public. Now, it's important to note, let's begin with this, that there is no federal charge for domestic terrorism.
It's the domestic being the key word there.
Domestic being the key word. So you cannot be charged in federal court if you have committed an act of terror, even though that act of terror is something which is covered by the federal government's definition under the Patriot Act of domestic terrorism. You still cannot be charged in federal court.
So it's in the Patriot Act.
It is.
But it's not what?
Right. So the Patriot Act does define domestic terrorism, but that is an investigation tool that if once you are classified as a domestic terrorist, the federal government can investigate you and the group that inspired you or you were associated with, but you still cannot be charged under federal law. The only way you can be charged with terrorism under federal law is if you are associated with or inspired by one of the 60 groups which are listed by the State Department, which are all foreign groups.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and we're kind of grappling with this issue of the word terrorism, the definition of terrorism, what it means when it's foreign, what it means when it's domestic. You just heard legal director for the Council on American-Islamic Relations in the Columbus chapter, Roman Iqbal, explain that it's in the Patriot Act, and it triggers investigations of domestic terrorism, but it is not defined in a way that permits a charge of domestic terrorism to be leveled.
And just to add another wrinkle, there are state laws now which do allow for a domestic terrorism charge. Like in D.C., they had a guy tried to attack the Family Research Council on LGBT issues, and that guy was charged, but that was under state law. It's confusing.
Or district law.
Well, the District of Columbia law, yes. Yeah. And some states actually have their own laws. Like, actually, Ohio has a law on if you're using a chemical weapon, for example, or explosive. So different states have different laws. But the federal law, you cannot be charged unless you're connected with one of the 60 foreign groups listed by the State Department.
Also with us, Emily Davidson. She teaches a course on media and terrorism at Ohio State. If you have questions or comments coming up in this hour, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Why does the implement, the device that's used to terrorize, matter?
It basically is an enhancer of the crime. If you're using a device that's premeditation, you obviously had to go source that device from somewhere. You probably had to learn how to prepare it. You probably had help. Somebody had to sell it to you. So that is just an enhancer in the severity of the crime when you're charged with it, and that's how it becomes relevant.
Huh. And and also in how it's used. The guy in Virginia who drove his car into the crowd in Charlottesville, Virginia, I think it was. There was a question there. He was a white nationalist. He drove his car into the crowd a la, ISIS tactics,
right,
well-known ISIS tactics. And there was a question about in that case as well.
Right. So, and you're talking about the Charlottesville case, right?
Yeah, the Charlottesville
case. So, again, that guy was not charged under terrorism.
Right.
He could not be there, but he was charged under hate crime. Mm-hmm. So you can still be charged under the hate crime. You just can't be charged under terrorism under federal law. It just simply does not exist if you belong to a domestic group. And that's just the state of the law, which is, of course, very different from in common parlance and in the media when we talk about the issue of terrorism.
But even in the media, Emily Davidson, it's a loaded term, mm-hmm. and the media doesn't use it as much when it's a white male perpetrating the crime as it does immediately if it's somebody of color, if it's somebody that could be or might be associated mm-hmm. with a foreign terrorist organization of any ilk. They suspected terrorist comes into play.
Absolutely. And I do think that the media will see what law enforcement has to say, and law enforcement has to be more guarded with the term because of legal issues. However, this deep dive into the perpetrator's background to try to find out why this was done is not something that we see with a terrorist or a perpetrator, I should say, who is Muslim, because the minute that you hear it's Muslim, the media says, okay, we understand this is the devil we know. We can just assume that this is terrorism. The questioning stops there. Whereas when it's one of us, fortunately, we do identify in America as a country that links itself to whiteness as a norm. So when it's one of us, we will see more investigation to find out what the defect is, because we don't like to think that one of us might do something like that. And so you see people less likely to use the word terrorist because they're trying to figure out why this one person from the in-group might go out and perpetrate such a horrendous act, where if it's someone from the out-group doing it, we just assume it's an inherent flaw in their culture that is causing it.
And what's the problem with that, Roman Iqbal?
Well, in common parlance, and we're outside the realm of what you can be charged in court. We're talking about the media now and how the public perceives it. I mean, as far as the public is concerned, if an act of mass violence which terrorizes the public, for most people, that does mean terrorism. And there clearly is a double standard as Emily pointed out, in going into looking into the motives of Muslim suspects versus the motives of suspects who are not Muslim. In fact, even within Muslims, if you look at the people who identify as Muslims who have been charged with committing acts of terror, the Boston bomber was the only one who was actually Muslim and also happened to be white. Mm-hmm. That's Sernaev Brothers. And their treatment was very different. I mean, there was a ridiculous Rolling Stones cover of the guy as the bomber, the story, but a very romantic looking, Sernaev Brother on the cover story. Mm-hmm. And he was the only, terrorist who actually was also happened to be Caucasian. He was from the Caucasus area. He was Chechenian.
Uh-huh.
So we see a difference in that as well. So obviously the question for a lot of American Muslims is that if a guy in Vegas kills, 56 people, or if, Dylann Roof, by the way, was not charged with terrorism or not
right.
called
mm-hmm.
a terrorist, and why is that? And that certainly is
the guy who went into the
church.
Church.
Right.
Charleston, yeah.
in Charleston. So that certainly is a concern, that why is that, that when a person is brown skinned and identifies as a Muslim, that he's immediately identified as a terrorist in the media. And this is before any investigation is done. This is before they know any of his motives, while a white supremacist, for example, who goes out and commits acts of terror is not identified as such in the media.
Yeah, and the media seems real comfortable with saying suspected terrorist at least.
Yeah, and you can see the same parallels if you look at the descriptions of an African-American youth who has been killed, who is a victim. You see delving into their past to try to figure out where they were not a nice person, or looking into
any infractions they've ever committed. Yeah. Is there evidence that that affects, that people, when they read it, that affects them in a certain way?
Our brains like to stereotype. We like to make very quick associations. And with Muslim Americans and Muslims in general, we don't get a lot of counter images. So in entertainment media or the news, when we see Muslims depicted, it is usually associated with terrorism. So our brain starts making that connection. And if you do a Google search for the word terrorist, the vast, vast majority of images are going to be this very stereotypical Muslim-looking terrorist. So it's just the way that our brain will picture that word now. So that when something falls outside of that frame, it's more difficult for us to process that information. So you might see someone hesitate to use the term because they just don't have that association. So I'm sure there are absolutely long-term effects. I mean, we see the hate crimes that in the UK, for example, absolutely spiked, where people are looking at very visible Muslims, like Muslim women wearing a hijab. They are Muslim in public, and they are being targeted because of that association, that idea that it's almost like an invasion that's happening for these people to be in your community.
And Roman Iqbal, is that the case here as well, that there is an uptick?
Right. There is an uptick in hate crimes. It has been, unfortunately, since November of 2016. In fact, since the summer of 2016, since the campaign started, we have certainly seen that increase in Central Ohio. And, you know, one of the other problems with media is that in addition to who is classified as a terrorist versus who is not, one of the other issues is that every time a suspect identifies as Muslim, there's also a tendency for the media to go, for example, to the mosque. Now, and in fact, in most cases, there is no indication the person had any connection with the act of terror in the mosque. But they would go, in fact, locally in Columbus, they would try to find out where did he go pray, even though there is no evidence. And research does suggest that there typically is no connection between where one goes to a mosque and an act of terror. While if you see now in Austin, no one is looking into, for example, whether did the person ever go to a church, and if he did, what church?
Well, there is actually, I think there's been coverage of that. I think he was homeschooled and from a very religious family. There's a lot, you know, that's kind of known about him. But what I've noticed is there's a tendency to always identify somebody, if they're Muslim, as Muslim, whereas there's less of a tendency to identify a white shooter or bomber or whatever the case may be as Christian or Jewish or whatever it might be.
Right.
It rolls off the tongue or something. So.
Right. And we have certainly seen that, as I said, you know, what you're saying of absolutely correct is identifying them as Muslim. We have no idea, for example, and it's just not that they say that person is Muslim. They would also go into their level of religiosity, for example. Mm-hmm. And typically there is no, you know, there's a lot of research being done on this, but there really is no connection between the level of religiosity, for example, and the act they've committed. We know a lot of it is online radicalization, but there is a tendency in the media to focus. And to going back to what I was saying is there is, you know, a tendency not to focus on not only on the level of religiosity, but also go interview the imam of the mosque, go look at the religious studies, and that, you know, would make sense if that had a connection or if there is a lead. But that, you know, the lead comes much later. The investigation takes time, but the immediate reaction is to focus solely on their religion and religiosity.
Yeah, and on the other hand, when it's a white perpetrator, it's the extent to which we can label them as mentally ill. Again,
there's more focus on that.
Yes, to try to point to them as a defect in society, not a product of the society. That way you don't have to examine, you know, white culture and see where that might produce someone that is capable of committing terrorism. So you just point to them and say, oh, they're mentally ill. They're not like the rest of the culture. So that's why they're perpetrating it. Whereas with Muslims, you see that immediate tie to the faith and saying, oh, well, this is a violent faith. So this is why this person has committed it.
And immediately anyone you see out and about who identifies obviously as Muslim is
right. And affected. And, you know, one of the things we have seen a lot of these cases that for example, in San Bernardino and Orlando, a lot of mm-hmm. these guys actually also committed domestic violence.
Yes.
So it seemed to me there's a common theme that people who, commit domestic violence also end up committing, you know, large acts of terror. Now, that is, however, never identified as a common theme. Right. Mm. Even though it's clear,
it's always the religion.
It's and there is just a hyper focus on not just religion and identifications. Also, as I said, the going to the mosque, the level of religiosity, who do they listen to online, and that would all make sense if the research suggested that they were somehow connected. But what the research does suggest is that at least now the radicalization is happening online and not at the mosque.
We'll continue our conversation. We're talking about how terrorism is defined. How do we define a terrorist in light of and in the wake of the Mark Condit, the white, Queerston, 23-year-old guy in Austin who set off all those bombs, killing two people? If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. In the aftermath of the string of bombings in the city of Austin, Texas, we're talking about the definition of terrorism and who should be identified as a terrorist and how the law works currently. Still with us is Emily Davidson. She teaches a course on media and terrorism at Ohio State. Also, legal director for the Council on American-Islamic Relations Columbus chapter, Roman Iqbal. Joining us now by phone is assistant director of research at the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino, Kevin Grisham. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Kevin, from where you sit, how do you define terrorism in the United States?
Well, you know, I mean, it's sort of a Pandora's box. I mean, there's no, of course, agreed-upon definition. Even the U.S. government, of course, has changed. Their definition has many multiple layers of definitions. And, in fact, what a lot of people don't realize is that we don't even have a defined definition of domestic terrorism. We've been sort of using what traditionally was created during the 1970s to address what was termed by the federal government as international terrorism to address some of the things going on within the United States.
Well, the Patriot Act does talk about domestic terrorism as a trigger for investigations, but there's no crime to be charged in that case.
That's true. That's true. So for example, when James Alex Spill, the driver in Charlottesville, mowed down the peaceful protesters there, he basically, one of the things that Jeff Sessions, our attorney general, said was that they would investigate, and there was some ambiguity, and that was part of the problem, is that they were allowed to actually investigate it, but they could not charge him for domestic terrorism.
And what do you think about that?
Well, I have two thoughts on it. One, as a scholar of terrorism of close to 25 years, it's a little hard to study something when you can't define it. And any good scholar will tell you that's the problematic nature of studying human beings. So you sort of end up finding yourself always in a quandary of what you classify as it or not. And then from the other side, sort of the legal side, it's a problem. We need to be able to make very clear that there's not just one group that commits acts of terrorism. In fact, we do know that more people have been killed by often what are not charged as domestic terrorism in the United States since 9/11 than international acts of terrorism within the United States.
I often look at the Oklahoma City bomber episode as a classic act of domestic terrorism.
Yes, and what's interesting is I think a lot of people don't realize that Timothy McVeigh was actually never charged with terrorism. What he was put to death for was a variety of other charges, including use of a weapon of mass destruction and used for murder. So, but a lot of people assume that because he's sort of the classic example that we can just use that as an example. That's just not the case.
Was this an issue back in the day, back in the 90s, after the Oklahoma City bombing?
It was. I mean, it's been an issue all along. And one of the sort of problems that people have brought up about whether we should actually have a federal crime that's defined as domestic terrorism is that at what point does then the government then label groups that would be considered maybe domestic terrorists, and would that potentially violate the First Amendment? So there's sort of this sort of juxtaposition of, you know, do we charge people and then therefore really adequately charge them for what they've done? And then also, you know, at what point does the government maybe potentially use that as an overreach? We see that overseas all the time with other governments around the world using this term terrorism and their laws to basically put down peaceful protesters. So I think that's something here.
Yeah. Roman Iqbal, what do you think about that?
I actually share some of the concerns that if you have a domestic terrorism statute, there would be some First Amendment implications. And that is something that we should all be concerned about. But the issue really is not about what, in the end, that the federal government charges you with in court. The issue more is in common parlance in the media is how we talk about this. And certainly when we are talking about this in the media, there really is no difference between a guy who, you know, Dylann Roof, who was, for example, not charged with terrorism, and the guy in Orlando. So at least in the media and common parlance and public, when we talk about this, I don't think there's any difference, even if legally there may be a difference.
Yeah. Kevin Grisham, I mean, is there any evidence that it does make a difference?
Well, I mean, I completely agree. I mean, we do see that people will view it. A great example, sometimes it's just very subliminal. One of the examples I often give in my classes is years ago when there was an attack overseas, the backdrop here in Southern California was actually the Palestinian flag was sort of above, behind the sort of titling of the story, and of course had nothing to do with the Palestinians. And yet this is sort of the narrative that we often see in the media, and that's problematic because we do know that that tends to motivate very problematic behavior. I mean, great example of this was one of the very first people killed right after the 9/11 attacks in a hate crime was actually a Sikh. People were immediately sort of, you know, using sort of these labels they had seen in the news, assuming that, first of all, that all terrorists are all Muslims are terrorists, which they are not. And we do know that there's terrorists that come from every walk of life. And so the reality is that this does become a problem because it becomes a narrative that then people just reinforce their views over time. And that can, of course, sometimes lead to very negative actions.
Yeah, I'm kind of grappling with this in my mind. So, and correct me if I'm wrong, but weren't the two guys in the Boston bombing, they were American citizens, weren't they?
They were, and so was, of course, the gentleman who committed the acts actually not very far from the campus I teach at in San Bernardino.
Right.
But and Orlando, too.
And Orlando, too, right.
And so there seems to be this, but we want to sort of put this label on it and then sort of say, well, you're the other, is the way that we talk about it in my classes. And it's just not true. And often a lot of people don't realize, no, these are actually American citizens that committed these acts.
Is this a double standard, Emily Davidson, in so much as they're American citizens? Where are their First Amendment rights?
Absolutely. I think the interesting statement made there that the idea that all Muslims are terrorists, but with the definition of terrorism legally being what it is, it's more all terrorists are Muslims because you can't use that term, but you only seem to apply it when they're Muslims. So again, when you have Muslim Americans or even just non-white perperpetrators, is they are othered from our society by those labels. You distance yourself from them by demonstrating that they are othered and assuming that there's some inherent trait that comes in the faith that makes it so that you should fear all of them. So yes, absolutely, it's a double standard. It seems as a way to push people outside of the in-group to create an othering kind of situation for them.
And Kevin Grisham, is the key here that maybe in those cases, and correct me if I'm wrong, but they may have been American citizens who happened to be Muslim, but they were also influenced by outside foreign sources or seen to be influenced by them? Is that a key there?
Well, from a legal perspective, I mean, that's part of what's happened. Increasingly, we know that extremists of all sort of are really reaching out and getting recruits, no matter who they are, through social media. And so when these attacks occur, if federal law enforcement can come in and say, well, look, we can prove that they tweeted or they somehow were at least showing to have some support, then they can sometimes take over the investigation, and then often they can then go after it as material support for international terrorism. The problem is very often in this day and age that that connection is tenuous at best. And sometimes people are acting out, have nothing to do even with these groups, but then the groups, of course, will use that to their advantage to try to make themselves seem bigger and much more powerful than they really are.
Roman Iqbal?
Yeah, I just wanted to add that, first of all, I agree, but what I wanted to add was that these people were categorized as terrorists in the media, in mass media, way before law enforcement actually was able to investigate and find a connection, however tenuous it may be. But the connection
so
came
cows out of the barn.
Absolutely. Yeah. Once a person, you know, looks visibly Muslim, and these two, by the Orlando San Bernardino people, were actually born in America.
Yeah.
They were second generation immigrants, so they were classified as terrorists way before any investigation was done.
Yeah. Emily Davidson?
Another thing with that tenuous association, a lot of what we've seen lately of these FBI foiling terror plots of organizations that are associated with ISIS or are trying to aid ISIS, recently it's been uncovered that a lot of it was just shy of, depending on your definitions, of entrapment, because it was actually the person they were talking to they thought was ISIS but was a member of the FBI who was actually coercing them. So to create those associations, there is somebody on the other side that's pushing to get you more involved in terrorism in order to foil that plot, but the association is really not there because they're not actually communicating with anyone outside the country.
Kevin Grisham, what's the difference in the bottom line besides, you know, the influence of a double standard and how it affects people's images of people of whatever ilk is being is the victim of the double standard? What is the bottom line in terms of law enforcement? Does it matter if you're an accused terrorist versus an accused, you know, domestic bomber?
Well, I mean, it's different. Of course, different resources can be put into it. We just saw this recently. For many years, we've had a very successful program called Countering Violent Extremism, and the idea was that you would go after all sorts of groups. And in fact, even the FBI was calling for greater concentration up until under the Obama administration to go after domestic terrorists, particularly white nationalist violent movements.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, when President Trump took office, there has been a switch. And in fact, just recently, what was Countering Violent Extremism has now been relabeled as Countering Islamic Violent Extremism. And so that's problematic because of course, officers are going to do what they're told to do. And so if the resources are then being put more to focus on that and not on these other groups that I would contend are a much larger threat to U.S. national security here and U.S. lives in the United States, then, of course, the problem is we're not really going after the people that could create the greatest harm possibly.
Mm-hmm. Roman?
And I think that in addition to that, if one particular group, aka Muslims in here, Muslim Americans, are, you know, identified in mass media as the only terrorists and all of the mass violence is not categorized as such, it is very consequential, not just for law enforcement, but also in perception. And that perception is consequential because that leads to hate crimes. That mm-hmm. would lead to discrimination. And that, you know, as we were talking about the case of the Sikh guy who was killed.
Yeah.
And we have seen an increase in hate crimes, and that is a result of the NFBI statistics do show an increase in hate crimes against Muslims, and that is a direct result of the public perception, and the public perception is influenced by the way the media talks about this issue.
Is there any evidence, Emily, that the American public is becoming more sophisticated at all after all these years?
What do you mean by sophisticated?
More understanding and more knowledgeable about religion and about all of this.
Well, we're seeing this.
Or are they just puppets, you know, just you know, bending in the wind to whatever the media has done.
We're seeing with the marches against gun violence, the recent March for Our Lives, that the youth tend to skew a little bit left and be a little bit more thoughtful, but they aren't immune to that repeated imagery. And I mentioned before, entertainment media. So you had like a show like 24 that ran from, 2001 to 2011, I think. So
the longest 24 hours in history, yeah.
Yeah, so it was a long-running show that had mostly Muslim antagonists who were being targeted by the main characters, and they were being tortured, and it was a good thing that they were being tortured because of they worked to get information. And we did see that as a result of people watching that show, that they had stronger support for things like torture and stronger support for extra legal counterterrorism and domestic surveillance, things like that, because they perceived this threat as being more urgent because of the nature of the show. And they even had CARE, the National CARE chapter, had Kiefer Sutherland did a PSA for one of the episodes and said, hey, in the show, your neighbor is a terrorist, but in real life, your neighbor isn't a terrorist. And they had to have this PSA because the people were reacting to this thinking, you have to be suspicious of your Muslim neighbors because anyone could be a terrorist and they are ruthless and we have to do anything we can to stop them. So even in entertainment media having that effect, you can imagine how much it is exacerbated when it's in the news media, too.
And I imagine those images from Abu Ghraib, you know, the torture that occurred there didn't help either.
Right. And if you look at the public polling, the favorability of Muslims, you know, when the people ask questions, who's your least, who do you look at least favorably in America? Muslims have now become our absolute dead last in all these polls. And then if the public, you know, has such a negative attitude towards Muslims and Americans, and it continues to get worse in this country. Obviously, that you see the effects of that on the street, you see that at workplace, and that really has real consequences for people's lives of Muslim Americans who live in this country, live in Ohio, and you can see that. You can see the harmful effects of that.
We are going to continue our conversation. That's Roman Iqbal. He's legal director for the Columbus chapter of the Council on American-Islamic Relations. Also with us, Emily Davidson. She teaches a course on media and terrorism at OSU. And Kevin Grisham. He's assistant director of research at the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino. Questions or comments? Give us a call. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Today we're talking about the definition of terrorism in the wake of the Austin bombings and why it matters, how we define people such as Mark Condit, the bomber. He's now dead, self-inflicted. Still with us, Emily Davidson, who built and teaches a course on media and terrorism at OSU. Legal Director for the Council on American-Islamic Relations in the Columbus Chapter, Roman Iqbal, and Assistant Director of Research at the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino, Kevin Grisham. Kevin, can we drill down a little bit deeper into this whole First Amendment issue and why that precludes a domestic terrorism charge? Is there something else that could be done, or will it always slam into the First Amendment, which, of course, I'm a big defender of?
Well, I don't know if we'll always slam down into it, but I think there is concern just because we've seen where people do use what we would call domestic terrorism to control groups in other parts of the world. So I think there is sort of reflecting on those countries. Our own country is, of course, very cautious of that. And so there has been an attempt. Mary McCord, who was the former acting director of the Justice Department's National Security Division under President Obama, said that actually under Obama and under the beginning of the Trump administration, there was still a task force to try to address and create a definition of domestic terrorism. But, of course, we don't know where that's at this point, given some shifts in the current administration.
Yeah. Roman Iqbal, what would you I want to talk about the stigma and how to address the stigma. But in the meantime, there seems to be this crime out there that
right.
nobody can really get a handle on.
Right. So the American Muslim community, you know, is not looking to expand the legal definition of terrorism so that domestic groups can. That's not the problem here. The problem for the American Muslim community is that when there's mass violence which terrorizes people, the media only talks about it in terms of terrorism when it's done by Muslims and ignores these terms when the act of this mass violence to terrorize people is committed by non-Muslims. So that's the double standard, you know, which concerns the American Muslim community. Now, as far as should the federal government be able to charge people under domestic terrorism? No, we don't believe that, because that certainly will have very serious First Amendment issues for all sorts of groups, the environmental groups, other groups in the country. So the point is not to just expand the definition. The point is just to be fair when the media is talking about it.
Okay. Well, why would it apply to environmental groups? What are they doing that would fall under that category?
Right. So the problem would be that, so let's say now you have a domestic terrorism federal charge. So what that would mean is that you would have to look into the ideology, because right now to charge somebody with international terrorism, you look at the State Department list of 60 odd groups which are on the list.
Mm-hmm.
So then if you are now going to have domestic terrorism, you would need to then have a list of domestic terrorist groups, and that would run into First Amendment issues of ideology, because who would the government put on that list of terrorist groups? You would have to look into the ideology, and there'll be all sorts of constitutional issues in addition to First Amendment.
So what sort of parallel universe could there be out there, Emily Davidson, that would create some parity?
I think It stems back to the media. If you look at how Muslim perpetrators are discussed, it's very I don't want to say objective, because that's not accurate, because it is skewed. But it's their name. It is, you know, their town where they were, their age. It's very, you know, objective, step back. Whereas you have these deep profiles. So there are two choices. You can either treat white or domestic terrorists at the same way and have just these very, you know, mechanical descriptions of them, or you can do deep dive biographical examinations of every terrorist, foreign and domestic, to find out the roots of their ideology, to find out what their concerns are, because a lot of radical Islamic terrorism comes from some pretty significant intervention from the West that has occurred in these Muslim-majority countries, and some legitimate concerns that have led to this extreme behavior that causes all these this loss of life. But it's not necessarily being explored, because you just treat it as terrorism and then don't explain why a person might do this unless they are white.
And, you know, something else to consider is that we already have laws. We really don't need any person to be charged with terrorism. If you kill someone, we already have laws against that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something else to consider, is that you don't have to really charge anyone with terrorism. If you kill 20 people, you can be charged with killing 20 people.
But there are hate crime laws, right, Kevin Grisham?
There is. And, you know, that's traditionally that's what has been used for, at least in recent years, when you have some of these attacks where the perpetrators are white in particular, is that hate crime will actually be sort of the defining charge, because we, in both federal crime but also in most state laws, if you are committing an act of violence with a hate crime, it actually can intensify the actual punishment. And I want to go back to Iqbal's point, because it's a very good point, which is, we do have laws on the both at the federal level and the state level that often can address these issues that we would want to call terrorism. But I do agree with both panelists that one of the things we do definitely have to do is get away from sort of the way the media tries to oversimplify what is really a very complex situation. And in doing that, the problem is often we paint these very stereotypical profiles of individuals that are much more complex than often the media has time to do, as well as viewers. We should try to become more sophisticated and ask more deeper questions.
Well, that's why I asked earlier. I mean, when as far as the American public goes, after all these years since 2011, when it really kicked into our radar, of course, there had been attacks previous before that, but it was different. Kevin Grisham, I mean, do you think the American public is becoming more sophisticated about this? Is it getting better, or is it, you know, does it remain kind of the pawn of whatever the media decides to do?
Well, I would like to think they are, but, you know, one of the things that we do at the center is one of the big things is we track hate crimes, and there clearly is some sort of correlation between how particular groups, particularly Muslims, are portrayed in the media and particularly by particular leaders, and seeing a big spike in hate crimes afterwards. And so that worries me very often. Also, and just but then there is hope, I think, sometimes, too. I know after the attacks a little over 2 years ago in our community, one of the big concerns was because we have a sizable Muslim American population in Southern California. And so there was a fear that there would be sort of a pushback. And there was in some cases. But I can tell you in San Bernardino, one of the proudest things I very often saw was young people standing next to other people from other faiths and really saying, look, they are not representation of the people that happen in our community. So I do at least have some faith that hopefully we're getting a little more sophisticated.
Defending them. We have an email from Tyler, who writes, there is abundant evidence linking increased economic hardship with increases in crimes of all kinds. Is the real issue not cultural, ethnic, or religious, but rather economic? After all, if someone has a stable income and can build the life they want for themselves, they're far less disposed to resenting the world they live in for whatever reason. The fact that we see this kind of behavior across different cultures, religions, and ethnicities indicates these are not causal factors. Does that come into your research at all, Kevin Grisham?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one of the things is I try to stay away from sort of the economic argument because there are clearly examples where maybe economics wasn't the issue, but more of the issue is marginalization. When populations are being marginalized, when individuals are being marginalized, there's many different factors that lead to that. We do know there's a great connection there, both in the U.S. and outside of the U.S. Just in the last 2 years in tracking recruitment of ISIS, we've looked at a lot of groups that Muslims and non-Muslims, a large portion of non-Muslims who've actually been arrested for material support of ISIS, and often what we find is that there's actually a marginalization factor where they don't feel they're part of the community. And we, of course, see that overseas. If you look at the attackers who are involved in the Paris attacks, as well as other places in Europe, often they're pushed to the outskirts of community and they're marginalized by those populations. And so that's, of course, worrisome. And so we want to definitely address that, because addressing that will address the bigger issue of terrorism.
Email from Brady. I agree 100% with the wrong stereotyping of Muslims as terrorists. However, with 9/11, ISIS, and media coverage of Muslim-related terrorist events over the decades, wouldn't it be very odd for humans around the world to not associate terrorism with Muslims? Is it really a double standard, Roman Iqbal?
Well, look, I mean, we all understand, obviously, that there is an issue. But the point of the American Muslim community is that the issue with does not only belong to American Muslims. This is not only an American Muslim issue, because when we are talking about violence and which terrorizes public, if there is abundant evidence that since 9/11 there has been lots and lots, in fact, majority of the mass violence to terrorize people has been committed by people who are not Muslims. So if the media continues to only, you know, classify Muslims as the terrorists, that obviously does harm, and that's not fair. Not only does it harm the American Muslim community, it's also not fair, because they're simply to ignore when other people terrorize, but when Muslims terrorize, to call it terrorism and say this is the only community which is exclusively committing these acts, that is certainly problematic.
What about Emily Davidson, when the president kind of after the Charlottesville, attack, the white nationalist who drove his car into the crowd and killed that young woman. He was kind of equivocating on it. What difference does that make?
I think it's glaring. I think it does send a message. I don't want to assume any motivation for doing that. Mm-hmm. But we saw the same thing with the Austin bomber. Until he was killed, the president didn't say anything. And then he congratulated law enforcement for his death. He didn't, you know, send any well wishes to the families of the victims, who were mostly minority. But yeah, so it does send a message. I don't want to speculate on why that's being done, but it does kind of tie into this broader idea of who we care about as victims and who we are concerned about as perpetrators. And there is this inflated concern for foreign terrorists, particularly Muslim terrorists, whereas the white nationalist concern in this country since 2012 has been kind of swept under the rug, while those attacks increase, specifically in terms of things that we label hate crimes since the 2016 election.
And there are, I mean, there's groups, Kevin Grisham, aren't there, that white nationalist groups that are listed by the government, that are followed by the government, aren't there, for their extremism and their hate and violence?
Well, there has been. Where that's at today, I couldn't tell you, but obviously there has been an attempt to after them, and it's really varied from administration to administration of how much emphasis is placed on that. Obviously, after 1995 and the Oklahoma City bombing, there was a greater emphasis on it. But today, who generally does most of the work in tracking these groups and looking at these groups is really individual non-governmental or nonprofit organizations, think tanks, and academics, because really the government may be tracking some of them, but we've really sort of switched over the years back and forth of how much emphasis we're put on. And after 9/11, we obviously put a very, very big focus on looking at, in particular, sadly enough, Muslim Americans, which obviously most of them, of course, will never, ever be involved in any of these sort of incidences. But yet they became a focus of resources and investigation. And as Emily pointed out, in some cases, we now know some cases law enforcement and trapping some people in some cases, potentially.
So, Emily Davidson, what do we do?
I think the notion of us versus them needs to be, well, not eradicated, but it needs to be adapted, that we need to broaden the idea of who is us. So the idea of someone who is an American citizen, or just a person in this country, or even a citizen of the world, that we understand more about the motivations behind committing these dangerous and terrible acts, then we can start identifying the root causes of terrorism. So since September 11th, and it was a devastating attack, but since then, terrorist attacks have spiked because of the counterterrorism efforts of the U.S. and then U.K. and other countries have implemented, that we need to look at how the actions of the West in their fight against, in the war of terror, fight against terrorism, are actually leading to more terrorism. So being able to identify those root causes and understand what leads individuals to terrorism will help us prevent it, much less than painting a picture of an all-Muslim terrorist organization in this country.
Roman Iqbal?
You know, I think that the best thing that can be done is for the media, actually, is that the media can, if the public gets a sense or is given statistics that, look, since 9/11, the vast, vast majority of mass violence in this country was committed by people who are not Muslims. If this was something which people were aware of,
And reminded of, and
if there is sometime an attack committed by a person who identifies as Muslim, if this statistic is brought up, if this context is given, I do believe that would certainly change the perception of a lot of people in this country about American Muslims.
Roman Iqbal, thanks for joining us again. I always appreciate your help.
Thank you.
Roman Iqbal, legal director for the Columbus chapter of the Council on American Islamic Relations. And Emily Davidson, thanks to you as well. I appreciate your time.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Emily Davidson teaches a course on media and terrorism at OSU. And Kevin Grisham, assistant director of research at the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino. Thanks for joining us, Kevin.
Thank you.
Thanks to everybody else for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.